It's to the best of our knowledge. Here's the question of the day. Are we doomed? I mean, seriously, it's possible that climate change is already irreversible. I think everybody at some level is scared about it. And also sad. I am.
I cried twice when my daughter was born. The first time for joy, as any father would. And the second time for sorrow.
This is writer Roy Scranton. His baby daughter is now almost 2 years old.
Here is the takeaway. Unless the world changes course quickly and dramatically, the fundamental systems that support human civilization are at risk. We begin tonight with our chief environmental correspondent.
It was 10 or 15 minutes after she'd been born, and I was holding her, this brand new life, looking out the window of our hospital room over the parking lot. All the concrete and thinking about how all this land around us, the world that she'd been born into, had once been this vibrant place full of wild animals and clean water and clean air. It had all been changed and was only going to get worse throughout her life. Thinking about the effects of catastrophic climate change, 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warming by the middle of the century, thinking about the death of the oceans, thinking about the massive extinction event going on right now, and just the way that we've despoiled and poisoned the world that we live in.
It's not just on land. The oceans are absorbing more carbon dioxide.
I didn't know what to say to her. I'd brought her into this world and not fully grasped what that would mean for her life. So all I could do was cry and apologize. Eventually come to make a promise to do my best to teach her how to live in this world, this damaged, doomed world, with some kind of grace and faith that she can still have a rich and meaningful life.
Hope means the ability to still
our
be here,
best futures
fighting.
Hope right there in your face.
Hope,
at the moment.
Optimism, happiness.
Hope works.
Hope is essential.
Hope rises. She always does.
I'm Anne Strandchamps. Welcome to Hope, a 3-part series from To the Best of Our Knowledge, Episode 3, our final episode. Are we doomed?
Hope is connected to faith.
Of what use is love if the situation is hopeless?
Let's do hope.
You know, it's hard to do hope with the specter of climate change looming. The future today feels uncertain in a way I don't ever remember. And if my neighbors, colleagues, Twitter, Facebook, and my kids are any evidence, I'm not alone. Add Roy Scranton to that list. That experience with his daughter turned into a book with an ominous title. We're doomed. Now what? Steve Paulson sat down with Scranton to find out, and I want to give you a heads up. This is going to touch on some ethical issues that some of you might find troubling, including suicide.
I want to quote something that you wrote a few years ago. Here's what you said. When I look into the future, I see water rising up to wash out lower Manhattan. I see food riots, hurricanes, and climate refugees. I see the 82nd Airborne Soldiers shooting looters. I see grid failure, wrecked harbors, Fukushima waste, and plagues. This is a really bleak view of the future. You're saying to really think about it, to confront it, we will change our lives because of this. We will think about what it means to lead a meaningful life in a different way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this is not only a possibility. I think this kind of reflection and reevaluation of what it means to live a human life is absolutely necessary, precisely because the effects of climate change on life as we know it are going to be so severe. It's not just rising seas and droughts and famines, right? Our whole value system, our whole conception of what it means to live a meaningful life in America is in crisis right now, and that crisis is only going to grow worse.
Explain that. What's wrong with our value system?
You know, what do we consider to be the good life in America? What's the American dream? You maybe own your own home, a couple cars, you're married and you have maybe a couple kids and some TVs, and you look forward to a blissful retirement when you get to travel the world on a cruise ship and go to Italy. That's simply not sustainable into the future. That's all built on 2 centuries of carbon exploitation of coal and oil that we've turned into human wealth.
You talk about some of the choices ahead for you as a parent and how you should raise your daughter. I mean, you say the question is, should you save for your daughter's college education or should you teach her to shoot, hunt, and live off the land?
Yeah. I mean, that question and framing it in that kind of dilemma is very much an attempt to try to get my head around this crisis in values.
So what about those teenagers who are listening to us right now, who are probably more focused on driver's ed or the prom or studying for the SATs? What do you say to them?
That the world is changing. And I mean, this is what we need to be thinking about, because we're all in that situation, focused on making our way in the world as it is. But that world is evaporating around us. What we're talking about is radical transformation of the entire environment that we live in the next 30 years. If we're looking at 2 to 3 degrees Celsius warming by 2050, which is the path we're on now, that's what the IPCC says, that's a radically swift and cataclysmic transformation.
So is it still possible to hope about the future?
It depends on what you want to hope for. For me, hope is always connected to faith, because you don't hope that you'll go to work in the morning. You know, I don't hope I'll change my daughter's diaper. I just do those things.
Right.
You hope for things that you don't have any control over. The question there is then what do you have faith in? Because that's where you can put your hope. Do I have faith that the economic elites and ruling classes and politicians and oil company executives and Silicon Valley investors who run the world that we live in now, do I have faith in them, in their wisdom and their ability to come together and put climate change center stage and to rebuild the global economy? No. I think such faith would be misplaced given their track record. I do have a faith in human resilience and the human ability to adapt to difficult situations and still find ways to lead meaningful and rich lives.
This is so complicated. I mean, so I have 2 kids. They're both in their early 20s, and they are saying that some of their friends are already making the decision not to have any children because of climate change. And I have a couple of reactions to that. I mean, one is it just makes me sad. That is how they see the future of the planet. And the other is, well, maybe this is also grounded in some really hard-headed realism.
Yeah, absolutely. The choices we face, the world that we face, is going to challenge us in every way. not just physically and not just politically, but ethically, we're not well equipped to know how to make this change.
Yeah, but I mean, as you say in your book, if you take this thinking to its logical conclusion, if you really want to save the planet, you should die. That would be the most earth-friendly choice to make. But that is the essence of nihilism, of not believing in any future. Collectively, we as a species stop having children, which is not going to happen. But I mean, that's basically saying we don't believe in the future. We're doomed.
You're right that the reductio ad absurdum of this belief that we're individually responsible in our consumer choices and in our lifestyle choices for climate change, the only way to follow that out to its fullest extent is to commit suicide, right? Because that's the best way to decrease your carbon footprint, full stop, right?
Right, yeah.
And I can't talk about that without mentioning David Buckle, the New York attorney who did just that. He lit himself on fire in Prospect Park as an act of protest to bring attention to climate change. And the memory of that act should stay with us. And that might be as well what some people decide when they decide not to have children. I don't know. I can't necessarily speak to that because, as you know, I didn't make that decision.
Right.
I decided to have a kid, even though having a child is one of the, in carbon footprint terms, it's one of the absolute worst things you can do.
So I have to ask, why did you and your wife decide to go ahead and have a kid?
Well, for a lot of reasons. For us, it felt like that this was the way to live the fullest possible human life, was to have another human, to continue the species. It's in effect making a commitment to the future.
Right.
To have a child is to commit oneself to a deep emotional and psychological investment in what happens over the next 50 years. It grounds you in a way that not having a child doesn't.
Because you're talking about how do we change from seeing more humans in the world as a blight on the planet to something that is hopeful and actually productive in some way.
Yeah. And we inhabit these contradictions, right? We live within these contradictions. There's still no sense in which adding more humans to the planet is a good idea. And yet, if we're committed to human existence at all, we have to keep making humans.
Right.
It's this conundrum, right? It's a contradiction that we just have to live within. But we're obligated, nonetheless, to commit to some radically different human future.
And maybe that's where that word faith comes in again.
That's right.
Roy Scranton is the author of We're Doomed, Now What? Steve Paulson talked with him. So I've listened to that interview 4 or 5 times now, and I have to confess, the first time, the day it was recorded, it made me so angry. I wound up having a huge argument with Steve. I said it paints an almost irresponsibly, deliberately bleak vision of the future. Steve said, "Are you kidding? It's one of the most realistic formulations of hope I've ever heard." And I said, "Hope? Where the is the hope?" Well, one of the good things about editing is it forces you to listen to things over and over again. And so it took me a while, but I did finally hear and begin to understand the hope. I think it's that, yes, we are facing the almost certain end of life as we know it now, and simultaneously, the real possibility of creating a new way of living on a changed planet. So that faith, it's in life itself, and its endless cycle of becoming and being. That's something writer Anne Lamott has been struggling with, too.
Life is way wilder than I am comfortable with. Way farther out, as we used to say. More magnificent, more deserving of awe, and I would add, more benevolent, well-meaning and kindly. Waves and particles, redwoods, poetry, this world of wonders and suffering, great crowds of helpers and humanitarians, here we are alive right now together. I worry myself sick about the melting ice caps, the escalating arms race, and the polluted air as I look forward with hope to the cleansing rains. The colors of autumn, the coming spring, the warmth of summer, the student marches. John Lennon said, "Everything will be okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end." And as this has always been true before, we can hope it will be again. We have all we need to come through. Against all odds, no matter what we've lost, no matter what messes we've made over time, no matter how dark the night, we offer and are offered kindness, soul, light, and food, which create breath and spaciousness, which create hope, sufficient unto the day.
That's Anne Lamott from her most recent book, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope. So that's the good news. Now for the bad news. Robots have taken over your popcorn.
Hello.
Amazon has recently debuted a microwave that you can talk to. So it's got Alexa enabled.
Your device is ready.
You may be wondering to yourself, why would I need to talk to my microwave? How hard is it to push a few buttons? But once you buy your box of popcorn or whatever it is from Amazon, every time you cook that thing and you're using your voice, Amazon is capable of collecting that data. You know, Amazon has a health initiative with JPMorgan Chase and Berkshire Hathaway. To me, it seems entirely plausible that I could get to my Amazon-connected refrigerator, decide that I want to drink a beer because I've had a long day of work, and the refrigerator won't open up. It knows that I've hit my caloric intake for the day.
That's futurist Amy Webb. Coming up, we'll hear more from her about the promise and perils of artificial intelligence. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. artificial intelligence is not, yet, on most people's list of things to worry about. It seems way too far off in the future. But actually, that future's already here. The spam filter in your email box? AI. The autocomplete on your iPhone? AI. The anti-lock braking system in your car? AI. AI tracks shipments and postal deliveries. It schedules flights. Artificial intelligence is making decisions for us all day long. And we like the convenience. You use Google Maps, right? Well, futurist Amy Webb says we are living through a slow-motion explosion of AI, and we're ceding control to it. Not to the technology itself, but to the companies developing it.
Walmart has filed a patent for a new kind of shopping cart. The first time a customer places their hands on it, it creates a baseline. It's looking for your temperature, your heart rate, and other biometric indicators. And as you move throughout the store, the shopping cart is constantly surveilling you to see if you are feeling stressed out. So your shopping cart is collecting your data. And if this entire system decides that you're stressed out because you can't find potato chips or whatever it is that you're looking for, it will tell a store associate who will come over and find you. I mean, it sounds creepy.
It sounds very creepy.
But from a retailer's point of view, all they're really trying to do is to anticipate our future needs and to solve problems for us before they arise. Now, in practical terms, let's say that we're in Walmart pushing that shopping cart around and I'm starting to feel really frustrated. It may have nothing at all to do with my store experience. Maybe I've just seen an email from a coworker and it's upset me. Or maybe I've seen something on a shelf that makes me sad because it reminds me of a loved one that I've lost. The challenge is that AI is still fairly rigid. And there's a small group of people with a limited worldview making these systems and tools and decisions that don't take into account the capricious nature of humans and how we think and go about our daily activities.
To make it a little worse, we should talk about the Chinese model, because right now the two main superpowers developing AI are the US and China. And some people, I think, were kind of shocked to read recently that China is using DNA and other digital data to track ethnic minority populations. But that's the tip of the iceberg.
So there are 9 companies that control the future of artificial intelligence. 6 are in the United States, 3 are in China. The 6 that are in the United States, I like to call the G Mafia. That's Google, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, Apple, and Facebook. And in China, they're called the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. In the United States, the G Mafia operate under very little scrutiny and regulation outside of normal business practices. They have an antagonistic relationship, or transactional on good days, with Washington, D.C. And because we live in a market economy where publicly traded companies have responsibilities to their shareholders, these companies are working on commercializing AI. That is a focus. That is not the case in China. So in China, the BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, are technically independent companies, but because it's China, they very much operate under the thumb of Beijing. And that has allowed China to use AI in service of social programs and big national strategies. So one that I'm sure people are familiar with is called the social credit score.
What is it? What's the social credit score?
So basically, citizens in China now get awarded points or demoted points depending on certain behaviors. So if you perform meritorious work, like a good deed, and a neighbor or a coworker reports you, points might be awarded.
Like I get points for shoveling my neighbor's sidewalk?
If they report it, yes. However, if you jaywalk in some of the southern provinces right now, smart cameras are on the street. They recognize who you are. Your face is put on a digital billboard and you are publicly shamed. And all of that is computed in real time where a score is levied, not unlike our credit scoring system, financial system in the US. And it has real world ramifications. So in the past year or so, 17 million Chinese people were prevented from buying airplane tickets. They didn't qualify because their scores were too low.
Whoa, you jaywalk too often and you're not allowed to buy airplane tickets?
Well, I think it was probably more than just that.
Right.
But 17 million people restricted. 5.5 million people were not able to buy train tickets. 300,000 people qualified for job promotions However, because their social credit scores were lower, they weren't able to move up. Now, you could be sitting wherever you're sitting in the country and saying to yourself, well, that sounds terrifying. Luckily for me, I don't live in China, therefore none of this has anything to do with me. And I would argue that the opposite is true. I believe that the world is being reshaped at this moment in time. China sees artificial intelligence as a route to creating a new world order, one in which the United States effectively and our allies become locked out of doing business with countries that are aligned with China. And our democratic ideals, which I happen to believe very strongly in, we could start seeing restricted or tampered with in new ways. We have a lot to be concerned about, and I think it's really incumbent on each person individually to think very pragmatically about the decisions that we're making and how those decisions could have broader implications in the future.
Running through all of these things, how much hope do you have for the future?
I actually have quite a bit of hope for the future. I do not believe that these big nine companies are the villains. I believe that if they change some of the developmental track and they make some decisions and some tweaks, that they are the heroes of this story, that they are the heroes of our future, and they can play a positive role. I believe that all of the promises that we've made about AI, promises that paint a picture of healthier lives and better opportunity, I believe those are possible. But our best futures never show up fully formed, and they don't happen automatically.
Yeah, I keep thinking about the analogy to climate change, and I think one of the things that makes thinking about the future right now so difficult for so many of us is the sense of climate despair and the sense of helplessness. At this point, there is nothing any individual can do to make a real dent in climate change. And on the other hand,
I completely disagree with that. Because for work, I'm constantly covering different technologies across different industry areas because they all interconnect and relate. So I've seen a tremendous amount of research in green tech that ranges from different types of geoengineering to terraforming in new ways. There's a ton of opportunity. The individual actions that each one of us can take, I think, have to do with communication. At the moment, there's a lot of individual protests where people have decided they're not going to use straws anymore, and somehow that's going to make a dent. What would make a much bigger dent is if consumers have more meaningful conversations with their elected officials. Those elected officials are willing to look at actual science and evidence and make smarter decisions. Companies who are stalwarts, they have plenty of opportunity. The petroleum industry can recalibrate a lot of what it's doing and still be a hero to its shareholders while also being a hero to the environment. It's just a matter of thinking through different possibilities and running out risk and opportunity scenarios in advance. Similarly, with artificial intelligence, every single one of us, me, you, my dad, my next door neighbor, my kid's teacher, all of us have a stake in what's coming, and all of us can play a role in making ourselves a better future. But I will tell you what gives me hope. What gives me hope is that we are not robots living out somebody else's legacy source code somewhere, which means that we all have agency. And even when I see dire consequences and catastrophic scenarios ahead, I know that we still have an opportunity to make different decisions. And I am full of hope. Hope is what gets me through my day. It really does. And I'm always hopeful, and I have confidence in that hope, that people will choose a better path. They just have to be armed with the right information, and they have to feel a sense of urgency.
Amy Webb is a futurist and author of The Big Nine: How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. Note the could.
Hope for me comes from my faith in other people, a faith in those that I've chosen to surround myself with, that those people will do the right thing.
In order for life on Earth to survive, it'll have to become life from Earth. and colonizing Mars would be one more step along that way.
Hope didn't come easy to me, and I found it, funnily enough, in a book. I was going through divorce, and I was reading Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Whenever I feel that my hope levels are going down, I take passages from that book, rethink them, and hope is restored, at least for the day.
What about you? What gives you hope? We'd love to know. We made it super easy to record your voice by clicking a button on our website. You'll find it at ttbook.org/hope. Share your thoughts and they just might wind up on the air. Still to come, an astronautical engineer argues there is only one hope for humanity, and it's on Mars. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. This hour, we've been talking about hope and asking, are we doomed? Well, if you watch or read much science fiction, you would think, absolutely. I mean, how many times have I seen scenes of children living in bunkers while clouds of virus wipe out everybody else? Or highways cracked and covered in vines while hordes of the undead chase down survivors? And that was just last season. Dystopian science fiction has been part of my entire life. Star Wars, The Matrix, The Hunger Games, hell, The War of the Worlds. Here's a thought. What if science fiction writers imagined a better future? Victor Laval is the editor of a collection of short stories that do just that. It's called A People's Future of the United States. He told Steve Paulson they are badass stories filled with hope.
Tell us about, I'm not sure if I'm saying the name right, Amerk Rustad. Our aim is not to die.
That's a story about a non-binary human being who lives in a world where you're forced to choose a gender or you are erased. And our protagonist can't and won't make that choice and therefore spends a large portion of the story in deep fear that when it comes time for the test, the time when they are forced to make their choice, they either lie about who they are or they face destruction. But thankfully, in that one, the protagonist finds friends.
I don't think we're giving away too much here, but the protagonist is this trans person, Sua, who has autism. And this is kind of this near future dystopian United States and discovers that actually AI is an ally.
That's right.
And I love it when the AI identifies itself as a collective whose mission is to protect the vulnerable.
One of the great surprises of that story, at least for me, even as a reader, was for me to realize I was very used to this sort of Skynet, you know, all technology is bad, they're out to kill us sort of story. And that part of being knocked out of my chair in that story was to sort of say, oh, right, that's right. We're supposed to think differently about the future for everyone. And in this case, everything.
Well, it also seems like one of the central questions you're asking in this anthology is, how do you find hope in desperate circumstances? If you're living in a world that's increasingly authoritarian or fear-mongering, where climate change is kind of looming over us, what does hope mean?
For a lot of the stories in this collection, hope largely means the ability to still be here fighting, right? The idea that hope means a happy ending, I think, number one, has ruined many, many people's lives, but two, doesn't take into account, to my mind, one of the beautiful things about life is that today things are great, tomorrow you start again. And things might go badly tomorrow, but then the day after that, you might try again. And that, I don't know, as human beings, I think that's a lot to get in this world, the chance to keep trying, to fail sometimes, and to sometimes succeed. That, to me, is, that's as happy an ending as I imagine humanity ever gets.
Wow. That's a great way to think about hope. Well, let's talk about another one of your stories, N.K. Jemisin. She has a story, Give Me Cornbread or Give Me Death. Can you give us a quick outline?
Sure. So this is our most fantastical story, I would say, in the sense that it's set in a world where there are dragons. Power has been seized by this great authority who have segmented people of color in particular into essentially like closed off ghettos or quadrants, and they use the dragons as a security force to hunt down and kill anyone from these groups of color who oversteps their bounds. But the narrator and her allies have come up with a plan, which is to feed the dragons really great ethnic food, for lack of a better term, and turn those dragons into, if not pets, allies. The towers are pissed. They send in cops to retaliate, arresting anybody who talks back, even killing two women for no reason at all. They feared for their lives, the cops say. They always say. Collard greens get added to the contraband list between C4 and contraception. We retaliate right back when they come with crews of deputized men from Americana to tear up our fields. No collards, fine. When the dragons come next, we offer them Callaloo. They come for the Callaloo. We just stand there pretending harmlessness and don't fight back. They can't admit that the dragons are supposed to eat us, so they claim they're worried about Listeria. After they take the Callaloo, longtime town, none of us name this dish, sends over frozen blocks of spinach cooked with garlic, fish sauce and chili oil, layered in with their heroin shipment. We have to add our own spinach to stretch it, but that chili oil is potent. It's enough. By this point, the towers figure they've either got to rob us of every vegetable and then watch us die of malnutrition, or there's no way their dragons will ever bother with bland, unseasoned human meat again. They actually try it, motherfuckers, burning our farms, and we have to eat cat grass just to get by. We fight over kohlrabi leaves grown in an old underground weed hothouse. Can't give this to the dragons. There isn't enough, and our daughters need it more. It's looking bad. But before the next raid, Spicy Mamaville smuggles over mofongo that makes the dragons moan. They love it so. Towelhead Township is starving and besieged, but a few of the Mujahideen women make it through the minefields with casks of harissa strapped to their bodies. Sari City, mad about Bali Town, ship us friendship basketballs. They do this openly, and the towers let them through as a goodwill gesture. Black people love basketball, right? Maybe it'll shut us up. And it does for a while. There's enough sag paneer and curry paste vacuum packed inside each ball to feed us and the dragons too. The towers burn our peppers and our allies respond with dead drops of hawaj, wasabi, chili pepper water. The towers try to starve us, but we just don't die. And each visit, I pet my dragon a little more. She watches me, looks for me when she lands, croons a little when I pet her. It's war. I check in with my girls before every meal and ask if they're still willing to serve. They are. We are resolved. We will win.
Wow, that was great.
Oh, good.
What you read is almost the ending, but there's a bit more of an ending. How does the story end?
I think I would say this story ends with a great meal.
That's very good. We'll leave it there. Yeah. Now, you end the introduction to this book where you talk about what you wanted these stories to accomplish. You said that you want the stories to be narratives that release us from the chokehold of the past. And I'm just wondering what stories can do that can actually release us from the past.
I find human beings, all of us, we're raised with degrees of prejudice and insularity because of who our family is, who our community is, our race, our class, our religion, all those things. And even the best of us, we're taught this or that thing about people. But the amazing thing about stories, whether it's in literature or film, TV or music, is that they have a way to sort of sneak under our defenses and make us think that people who we never met before, that they might have hopes and dreams and fears just like we do. And I think at this point now I realize like that's not an immediate human way of thinking. If we are animals, we are pack animals in a lot of ways.
Right.
But stories find a way to like trick me into extending the circle of humanity.
You're talking about the power of art too.
Yes.
It doesn't just operate on a rational level. It does something else that's kind of magical in a way.
It is absolutely magic. There's no reason it should do what it does, like a series of characters on a page or on a screen or a painting or a sculpture. Why should that thing somehow sort of like crack you open in a way that, say, being harangued by somebody for 20 minutes will never do, or 20 years will never do? Who knows? But that's the power of doing this thing we do.
Victor Laval is the editor of the collection of speculative fiction stories called A People's Future of the United States. Steve Paulson talked with him. You know, sometimes fact really is stranger than fiction. For instance, Elon Musk is making cars, yes, but he's also making concrete plans to send a spaceship full of people to Mars in 20 years. I mean, with any luck, you and I will be alive to see that. We could even be on the ship. Robert Zubrin says it's about time. Zubrin holds advanced degrees in aeronautics, astronautics, and nuclear engineering. He has 3 U.S. patents, 5 pending, in space propulsion and exploration. He used to work as an engineer at Lockheed Martin Astronautics. And, oh yeah, as Charles Monroe Kane found out, he is the most enthusiastic cheerleader for colonizing Mars you will ever meet.
So, Robert, I have like a really simple question to start. Are we ready for humans to go to Mars? I mean, is there an idea or an invention or something missing, or are we ready to go?
From a technical point of view, we're entirely ready. We're much better prepared today to send people to Mars than we were to send men to the moon in 1961, and we were there 8 years later. Given a serious decision, we could certainly have people on Mars within 10 years.
What is the serious decision? Who makes the decision?
Well, there's basically 2 possibilities right now. One is NASA, which has immense resources,
yeah,
but is not prepared to make such a decision. And the other is Elon Musk, who has much less resources, but nevertheless substantial, and who is quite decisive. So while I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago or even five, at this point, I think that it's likely that Musk will get to Mars before NASA.
When's this going to happen? When's it going to start?
Well, parts of it have started. As I say,
when is the human foot going to land on that planet? When are we going to get there?
You can never be sure about the future, but if Musk keeps moving forward at the same rate he currently is, I would say they would land before the end of the 2020s.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 67.
So that's your lifetime, and you've earned the right to see that happen, I think.
Yeah, frankly, I was 17 when we landed on the moon, and if anybody told me then that I'd be 67 and we wouldn't have cities on the moon and Mars, I would have thought they were crazy.
Let's stay on Mars now. We're there. We're people are going there. There's some different missions, so now it's building up. Why would it be good for Earth to go to Mars?
Oh, well, first is the reason that NASA gives for the science. We're going to be able to find out if life is unique to the Earth or a general phenomenon in the universe. There's the challenge, the very positive stimulus to a society given by challenge, particularly to the youth. Learn your science and you could be a pioneer of new worlds.
Right.
But then there is the Martian society itself. And I think it's going to be an engine for invention because the Martians are going to be a group of technologically adept people in a frontier environment where they're strongly challenged, where they're forced to innovate and they're free to innovate and they're going to innovate.
Yeah, of course. We have a history of that, right?
Yes, we do. I mean, here's the thing. What is the greatest danger that humanity faces? What caused the disasters of the 20th century was bad ideas. And in particular,
right.
Variants of one continuous bad idea, which is that there isn't enough to go around. And so we have to fight each other for what is. We have to push other people aside or even exterminate them in order to take what there is. And this idea is still around. I know for a fact, because I've spoken with them, that there are people in the Pentagon in Washington who look at the rise of China and say, this has got to be stopped because if they all become middle class, they'll use too much oil. There won't be enough oil in the world. We have to stop them from developing. And if these ideas prevail, there will be more wars. Human exploration and settlement of Mars is a disproof of this theory. Okay, it shows that the resources are defined by human creativity, that we can open up whole new worlds of resources if we exercise our creativity and do it even better if we work together at it. It's the only positive answer to this thing.
You know what my wife would say if she was sitting right here right now? Because we've been talking about this recently because you're always doing this interview. She would say, hey, why should we go and screw up another planet when we haven't fixed our own first? What do you say to that?
Well, to take an extreme example, there are some people who compare humans landing on Mars to Europeans destroying the Native Americans and the bison and the redwood forests and all this stuff, okay? And there's no question that something valuable and precious was destroyed in that process. But yet, if there had been nothing in the Americas when Columbus landed, then a barren desert with no Native Americans, no bison, no redwood trees, not a single blade of grass, just a bunch of rocks with maybe a little bit of bacteria hidden under them. And they turned that into a continental nation of liberty with 1,000 universities and 100,000 used bookstores. Would anybody be picketing Columbus Day parades today? I don't think so.
Wow. So is this utopian? Are you a utopian?
No, I don't think Mars is going to be a utopia. I think it's going to be a mess, a great mess. That is to say, it's going to be a lab. It's going to be a place where new ideas are tried out, and a lot of them aren't going to work, but some of them will. And that's what we need. We need to have a place where people can go where the rules haven't been written yet, so they can give new ideas a try. And that's what Mars is going to be.
You used the word hope. I'm interested in this word. I mean, is that what we need?
I think hope is essential. Despair is the worst of sins. The lack of hope is the worst of sins because it causes you to give up striving for anything better. None of the virtues can be actualized if you think the situation is hopeless. Of what use is courage if the situation is hopeless? Of what use is wisdom if the situation is hopeless? Of what use is love if the situation is hopeless? So here's the thing. The planet isn't little. It comes with an infinite sky. Okay, the Earth is in space. And if we're not confined to just this part of space, but to have unlimited reach into all of space, then clearly we don't need to fight over this tiny corner of the universe.
Let's assume Elon Musk sends people to Mars.
Okay.
Okay, you and I are still alive. How do you think that will be viewed on Earth?
I mean, look, let me tell you something, a story. In 1969, when we landed on the moon, I was actually in Leningrad because I was a young chess player. And I was studying Russian because you had to be able to read the Soviet chess texts if you wanted to be a serious chess player at that time.
Uh-huh.
And so I knew some Russians, other chess players, and a lot of Russians that I met in the street because they played chess in parks and everywhere. So I could meet a lot of people that way. And they were over-the-top enthusiastic about it. I mean, the leaders must have been having kittens, but the regular people there, you know, they punch me on the shoulder and say, Molodets, which is like, attaboy. They thought it was swell. We had excelled at a sport they appreciated. And what Musk is doing is really a tremendous ad for human creativity, for freedom. What this is saying is you untie people's hands and they can do amazing things.
Wow. Sign me up. Robert Zubrin is an astronautical engineer and the author of A Case for Space: How the Revolution in Spaceflight Opens Up a Future of Limitless Possibility. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. Our three-part series on hope ends with this episode, but if you want to listen again, share, memorize, or hey, write about it, you'll find the whole series at ttbook.org/hope. And of course, you can find it any place you get your podcasts. We have so many people to thank for making this series possible. Our distributor, PRX, who went the extra mile. Our public radio home of Wisconsin Public Radio, especially the wonderful people who produce The Morning Show. Composer Wendell Patrick, who created the perfect musical score for Alice Walker's poem. Angelo Bautista for meticulous editing and great advice. Mark Rickers for original art and creative digital and social media strategy. Joe Hartke for always inspired sound design. Steve Paulson for leadership and encouragement. And lastly, I want to thank the lead producers of this series on hope, Charles Monroe Kane and Shannon Henry Kleiber. They had a vision of what this could be, and they made it happen. I'm Anne Strange Amps. I feel better for being part of this series, and I hope you do too.